Well, sometimes it can seem almost impossible to replace our traditional sources of energy with more green alternatives. But in fact, we need to be investing in innovative research that is happening in the labs all around the state and nation. Certainly here in Wisconsin, we've got lots of good things going on, and we'll be talking with you about it next. We always enjoy getting updates from the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, GLBRC, as we always call it. And today, John Greenler's back. Hey, it's been a while, John.
It's great to be back. Thanks, Larry.
I know you had a little injury that set you on your heels a little bit, but it's...
Took a slip, and I'm good now, though, so thank
yeah, you.
You
look great. It's good to have you back.
Thank you.
John directs the education for both the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Also with us today, Carol Barford is the director of the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment. It's called SAGE, and also a research scientist in the Nelson Institute at UW. And Carol, welcome to the show. Great to have you with us.
Thanks very much.
It's always fun to talk about what's going on in the Great Lakes Regional Bioenergy Center, the research center. John, what are the different kinds of crops that can be grown and used for energy that we're looking at?
Sure. You know, it ranges, you know, quite widely. I think we're, you know, most of us are familiar today with, you know, our use here in the Midwest of growing corn grain for the production of ethanol through, you know, a tried and true fermentation process. But really, you know, on the horizon and really kind of rolling out commercially this coming year are a lot of new and different types of crops and utilizations of plant biomass. A lot of it focuses on this woody fibrous material. So not all of it's woody. Some of it is actually residue material from agricultural practices, such as growing that corn grain. After we harvest the grain, we have about, you know, 50% of the above ground portion of the plant remains, what in the world of farming we call corn stover. And that material is largely kind of cell wall material, cellulose and the like, has a lot of energy in it. And we really are learning and figuring out how to utilize that, break that those materials down into sugars, for example, and turn them into liquid fuels like ethanol. But we can be doing the same thing with woody materials from forestry, whether that be in northern Wisconsin or you know, in the Pacific Northwest or the southeast of the country as well.
What about the different forms of energy can we produce from these crops? And maybe Carol, you can talk about that.
Yeah, well, you can produce ethanol, as John just mentioned,
right,
or you can burn stuff directly to make electric power or to make heat. So depending on what you need.
Okay, you can go one way or the other. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in as well here, which I didn't do right at the start. You may have an interest in bioenergy. Would you be the first in line to use it in your car or for some other energy use? Would you be willing to pay more for power if you knew it was coming from a more environmentally friendly source? Those are some good things to think about and ask about. And you may have some other questions, too. So give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or you could also post a question on my Facebook page, and that's the Larry Mueller Show. So certainly we would love to hear from you. Carol, what are the factors that need to be taken into account to determine whether or not a crop is feasible for bioenergy here in the state?
Well, there are a few different aspects of feasibility. There's the technical feasibility, like can you burn it in a reactor? Will it make too much ash? Can you load it in effectively? Can you get it to the plant in an efficient way? So there are those kinds of factors. The other kinds of factors that I've studied more are the farm level factors. Can the farmer make a profit growing the stuff? Is it compatible with the rest of his operation? Does he have the equipment to harvest and to ship it? So there are a couple different levels of feasibility.
How do you study that?
Well, I did a farm level feasibility study, and I had to use a few different kinds of data to get what I was looking for. First of all, environmental kinds of data, temperature and precipitation and soil data, just to be able to figure out, well, how well is the bioenergy crop going to grow across the state? I did this across the state of Wisconsin, and my sort of guinea pig bioenergy crop was switchgrass, which is native to this part of the country and pretty well understood from an agronomic, from a growing perspective.
Yeah.
So I had that kind of data. And then I needed data about farms and their basically economic situation. How big are the, is the farm? What else do they grow? What's their income? And what kind of equipment do they have? Do they have a truck? Can they truck the biomass products? So those different kinds of data were needed to look at feasibility.
And they all go into this big stew pot and they kind of
computer.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Dave in Minocqua has a question for you. Hi, Dave. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Hi, folks. I like your show today. I just thought it was long past due to once again bring up the idea of industrial hemp. You know, it was widely used during World War II for so many things, and it can be used for so many things, I believe, even including fuel, but it can be used for food and textiles, and, you know, it goes on and on. In Europe, they have widespread use of it. Canada, to our north, they have widespread use, but here we just keep on dragging our feet with it because we're so afraid of, you know, that it's hemp. And I think that's a crop that you don't have to really put much into. It grows on its own. It's a plant that puts a lot of O2 out in the air. And there's a lot of uses from it, including, I believe, fuel. So is there any discussion that you can see on the horizon that may include industrial hemp?
All right.
Yeah, it's an interesting case study looking at hemp, and you know, you're right. Actually, you can make a lot of fuel from hemp. It's a good example of, once again, this fibrous type of plant material has a lot of cellulose in it, and the cellulose is a polymer of glucose, which you can then use to make any of a number of different types of fuels. One of the challenges with hemp, and you really have to look at it on a relative basis, and we were just talking about switchgrass, and that's a good comparison point, because hemp is actually is an annual, so you have to replant that crop on a yearly basis. And so that there are a couple of things that come out of that. One is that there's the energy inputs, just having to plow and cultivate each year. But then there's also the energy inputs that are required for a crop like that in terms of fertilizer as well. And this is, once again, it's relative to something like switchgrass, which is a perennial native, and that native aspect brings some benefits. But in terms of that perenniality, one of the big things you get there is that you plant once and you may get, you know, 20 or more years of harvesting out of that one planting. So you don't have to go in with heavy duty machinery for planting each year. And also, because of the fact that switchgrass actually develops very deep roots, because those roots survive, they overwinter and they keep going down further and further, they're very, very efficient at tapping into deep reserves, both in terms of nutrients and in terms of water. And also the nutrients that are in the above ground portion of the plant of switchgrass go down into the roots each winter and then come back up again when the above ground portion grows in the spring. And so there's a lot more efficiency in a crop like switchgrass, probably very similar yields, but once again, without all the inputs. So, you know, for your dollar, for your energy, you're just going to get a lot more out of something like switchgrass relative to hemp.
And Carol, as you look at that now, you look at environmental quality, you look at profit, you look at reducing risk. In terms of environmental quality, I would think the environmental quality would be better with a crop like switchgrass than as opposed to hemp, for example.
That's always an interesting question because it kind of depends on what you're replacing and what your other options are on the land that you're interested in. If you are already growing pasture and you want to convert it to switchgrass, then maybe that's not so great because you have to plow everything up to plant the switchgrass. Mm-hmm. If you already have a row crop on land that's environmentally sensitive, then maybe planting switchgrass mm-hmm. is a good idea because you're going to stop plowing it and put the grass and leave it there for a period of years. So, you know, it's tempting to make blanket statements about what's environmentally friendly, but it kind of depends on the situation.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, you really have to. There's so much of this is a case-by-case basis of looking at the conditions on that particular farm and even a particular field.
Dave, thanks again for calling. I appreciate your call very much. Talking today about what's going on at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and really zeroing in a bit on farms and agriculture in Wisconsin and the energy needs associated with them and how we might be able to develop energy from new crops, especially crops other than corn. Corn has been successful, but it's that's one that uses a fair amount of inputs that, you know, make it tough to be environmentally sound.
Yes, corn uses a lot of inputs. It takes a lot of fertilizer to grow corn, which is then, if fertilized, is an extremely productive plant and can even fix a lot of carbon out of the atmosphere. But again, there are trade-offs. So there's a lot of fertilizer that goes into growing corn. A lot of diesel gets used for all of the field operations. So it's a intensive enterprise.
Yeah, absolutely. Are there others that we're finding the same sort of thing with or not?
Well, it's interesting to compare. I mean, you know, another crop that we have a lot here in the state is soybeans. And, you know, on a per acre basis, it doesn't take as much to grow beans, but you get a lot less out as well. And so, once again, there's kind of it's interesting to look at kind of the net in versus out. It's really, once again, it kind of comes back to that relativity. It's easy to say, well, how many gallons of fuel am I going to get out of this acre? But we really need to say, yeah, and how much energy do we have to put into that acre relative to what we got out?
I'm going to take a quick look at the news here. Carol Barford's one of our guests today who directs the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environmental Research Environment, I'm sorry, SAGE. And John Greenler directs education for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. They'll be with us right up until 12:30. We'll take a look at the news. Then we'll be right back. Stay with us. The University of Wisconsin is a leader in many fields, and certainly bioenergy and green technology is no exception. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We're talking today, and it's always exciting to hear what's going on at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. And John Greenler back with us again today, directs education for both the GLBRC and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. And John, always great to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry.
And with us as well, Carol Barford. And Carol is the director of the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment, called SAGE, and then is a research scientist in the Nelson Institute at the UW-Madison. And Carol, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And, of course, we're talking with them about research going on at the GLBRC, the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research, and zeroing in a little bit today on farms and agriculture in Wisconsin and the energy needs of that industry, but also how that industry, the farming industry, can help us, perhaps supply us with new sources of fuel. And there's a lot of research going on in that area. You may have a question, a comment. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page, at the Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And, you know, the there's a science expedition event. I want to make sure I don't forget to bring this up. So let's bring that up right now. You guys are going to be front and center on the UW-Madison campus at this event. What is it about?
Yeah, so it's 3 days of really fun and engaging science content coming out of the University Research Science Expeditions. It starts Friday, April 4th, and goes through Sunday the 6th. And I would really encourage people to go to the URL is www.science.wisc.edu, science.wisc.edu. And on Saturday, we'll actually be at the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery. We'll have a hands-on exploration station related to energy broadly. It's really for all ages. Great event for families. Yeah, so we'll be at WID, the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery, from I believe it's 10 to 2 on Saturday. But it's 3 days of nonstop events. So I would really encourage people to go to the website and take a look at all the different opportunities that will be there. So, because UW-Madison really is a pioneer, not only in science, but also in science education. And this is really kind of one of our main opportunities for people to engage and learn more about what's going on here on campus.
It's really it's a fun event. And we'll post it up on my Facebook page. Judith will get it up there. And certainly that's great. In the meantime, you want to join in. Maybe you've got a question about bioenergy. Would you be the first to use it in your car? That's something I mentioned earlier, or for other energy uses. Would you be willing to pay more for power if you knew it was coming from a more environmentally friendly source? Love to hear from you. I had a Facebook comment from Carl, which I thought was interesting. He said, let's review the ability of our state to provide a large percentage of our heating fuels with local renewable biomass burned in high-efficiency equipment. Let's keep our fuel dollars here in Wisconsin rather than exporting our money to other parts of the U.S. or even overseas. John, maybe a comment from you first.
Yeah, it is a very interesting question to say, well, we have these different sources of energy. What's the best use, for those materials? And we really need to look at, what are the supplies of these different types of sources, whether it be biomass or other types of materials, and what are our energy needs? Because they really are, quite diverse from, transportation. So we need liquid fuels. And mm-hmm. right now, those largely that comes from petroleum, from oil that we, pump from underground. But then, heating and electricity are also very significant energy needs that we have as well. And we need to look at all the alternatives and really kind of do the analysis and say, what's going to be best for these particular types of needs. So, how we move things around is really significant. So if there's a local source that we can apply to a local need, that can frequently be a lot more efficient because we don't need to move that energy source a long distance. Anytime you need to move something, it's going to cost you a lot of money and a lot of energy as well. So this is a big conundrum, especially for a lot of these biomass materials, because they can be very lightweight materials. The energy density isn't high, so you've got a lot of volume you need to move around. Using them locally can make a big difference. And the other option is to find ways to densify that material before we move it around. So we kind of need to play matchmaker of sorts to figure out, how to use these different materials.
John in West Bend has a question. John, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hey, good morning. Could you help me out? I realize this is going to be a finite number because of soil and when you harvest and the amount of sun, but how many calories or BTUs net BTUs would you generate off of an acre of this switch gas and net BTUs and convert that into, what would that equate to in, say, automobile gasoline?
Okay. Well, can we do that right off the top?
Wow.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Not in my head. With a few acres of switchgrass, a farmer could heat his house on an annual basis, could also potentially fuel some heat applications on the farm, like if he had a dairy parlor that needed to be heated, heating hot water, mm-hmm. or a greenhouse. So it doesn't take too many acres to make a big difference on the dollars spent for energy, heat, and or power on a farm.
Okay.
to start selling it then becomes a much more complicated issue of what would it be replacing and what's the price of the fuel it would be replacing. So I guess that's one way to answer the question.
Yeah, that's not a bad way to look at it. John, you're going to answer them?
Yeah, I can. You know, just on a larger scale perspective, the USDA some years ago did a really critical study called the Billion Ton Study, which basically asked a similar question but on a larger scale, saying, you know, if here in the United States we really looked at all of this fibrous plant material that we had available to us, it's residue material, or we could be growing a switchgrass on appropriate lands, we'd actually be able to grow about 1.3 billion tons per year. And that's clearly a very large number. And the question is, well, yeah, how far does that really go? And if we converted that material into liquid fuels, we could replace essentially about 30% of our liquid fuel needs here in the United States. Correspondingly, if you looked at our total energy portfolio, that would be about 10% of the energy that we use kind of across our full portfolio of energy needs. So it's, you know, these are really significant numbers, that we're talking about. It could make a big difference on a national scale in terms of our energy portfolio moving more in a sustainable direction, a renewable direction.
You know, though, if you look at that kind of calculation in a different context, say in Wisconsin here, sometimes we talk about growing bioenergy crops on conservation reserve land, you know, set-aside land. If you planted all of that in Wisconsin to switchgrass, it would still provide less than 2% of the heat and power needs of Wisconsin. So,
right.
You know, we use a lot of fossil energy. And that's just another way to kind of look at the relative magnitude of the bio and the fossil.
Right. It's really, you know, when we look at those kinds of numbers, we're talking about stitching together biomass from a wide range of different sources. It even includes, you know, urban, plant residues, woody residues. You know, we think about all the, you know, tree work that needs to be done or leaves. I mean, we're pulling it together from a very wide range of different sources to come up with those kinds of numbers.
It was interesting. I just got back from 2 weeks with Wisconsin Public Radio Listener Group from Hawaii a couple days ago, where the temperature is always between about 75 and 80 or 85. And they're doing a lot of work because they have to import.
Exactly.
Everything, you know, there's no oil there, and, you know, it all has to be imported, and so they're doing a lot of work there with crops of a types, as well as wind and as well as, oh, I'm blanking here suddenly, but they're kind of a leading state.
Right, ocean currents, I know, is a big one
is
that they're tapping
one,
into. Right, but they're a very interesting case study because not only do they need to import everything, but they need to import it from far away. So once again, it's that transportation issue of, you know, how far in do you have to be bringing that material? Yeah, and if we look globally, you know, there's a wide range of different materials. You know, an interesting case study is looking at Brazil. You know, they can grow a very large amount of a perennial grass, sugarcane, and which has, you know, very high levels of sugars that you can just basically wring out of the plant. And, you know, if we went to Brazil, we'd find that we'd be driving on essentially, you know, mostly ethanol, 85% ethanol, E85 vehicles. They've really, you know, put their, you know, their resources into that pot. And there's some really good sides to that story, and there's some concerns as well. So.
But it's really interesting. Oh, the other was not kind of related in a way, but solar is on, I think, virtually every home.
Right.
They're putting it on virtually every home in Hawaii, and that with some huge savings. So. That's a little off this topic, but it was interesting for me to I had never visited Hawaii, so it was interesting to see in a place like that where they really distance is a problem.
Right.
How they deal with it. Eric in Cashton, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hello, good afternoon. I've got two questions. One is whether there are ways for farmers to get involved in some of the research that's happening. And then the second is whether there's any partnerships happening with growing co-ops or groups of farmers in the state.
Oh, okay. Some big cooperatives. There were a lot of cooperatives in the state. That's one aspect. I think that's what you were asking about, one of the areas, Eric?
Yeah, it just in working with some of the growing co-ops to find farmers that might be interested in doing test plots and potentially on-farm research.
Okay. John, what about it?
Yeah, so, you know, this opportunity, you know, it, I think it's really, you know, it's on the horizon, and we're not there yet. We got close a little while ago when there was the serious consideration of actually having a power plant here on the UW campus, a Charter Street plant that would be one of the burners was actually at one point designated for biomass combustion. And at that point in time, there was a lot of discussion exactly along these lines of how do we build the ability to produce enough biomass to have actually fed that plant. And at that point, there was a lot of discussion with some of the cooperatives, I think especially in Southwest Wisconsin, to take those steps. At this point, we're really kind of back on hold, looking for the opportunity for there to be enough demand that we could actually engage farmers in this. In parallel, there's some really interesting research going on looking at, coming up with new varieties of switchgrass that are higher yielding. So Mike Kassler, for example, here on the UW campus is a plant breeder who one of his primary foci is on switchgrass. And it's amazing the work that he's done to really bring up the biomass yields for switchgrass. Switchgrass, as Carol was saying, is a native. And really, there's been very little work done to say, how much can we actually produce per acre if we apply some of our modern, plant breeding, work to it. And we're just beginning to get there on that as well. So I think the answer at this point in time is we're not quite there yet. And we're hoping that not too distant future will really have that opportunity for more engagement with farmers.
And Carol, you wanted to add something.
Yeah, it's interesting that Eric mentioned cooperatives, because one of the big bottlenecks with biomass are the logistics, how to truck it and deliver it and how to store it. And one barrier to production is on a farm. Where would you store all of the biomass? And in some cases, in some parts of the state, more infrastructure, if you want to think of it that way, to store biomass at aggregation point like a co-op could be really helpful, because it could even be acres of storage that are needed to keeping it dry, keeping it off the ground. Even if it's something simple like pallets with a tarp over it, it's you got to have some place to put it. So the nuts and bolts of the logistics turn out to be, as John mentioned earlier, with this bulky material, pretty important.
Yeah. Right. We've got some interesting research going on in the center, actually, as Carol was mentioning, to actually pelletize, some of this material, which does two things. One, it makes it more energy dense. It also stabilizes it. So you can store it for a long period of time, which is critical. We're going to harvest this type of material probably once a year. But then, if you're, using it for making fuel or as a power source, you need this steady supply year round. And so that's some very interesting work that's actually being done at Michigan State University, which is one of our GLBRC partners.
Yeah, very cool. Eric, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Ivy in Evansville, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I look around at what growing corn has done to the area here, and I see so much erosion and cut down of hedgerows, and it seems like the land is being mined. And so I thought switchgrass would be great, mentioned it to my brother-in-law, who's a botanist, and he said, yeah, well, the first thing you know is they'd be planting it on all the marginal lands that are left with native prairie plants and that sort of thing. And one of the concerns I have, and I'm not opposed to switchgrass, but I hope that these are built into the models, is that if you harvest it while birds are nesting, you'll be creating a sink for ground nesting prairie birds. And I hope that's just brought into the mix. And it's often with wind and these other issues, though, that becomes a problem too. But I really like to see something like this, but I hope that those things are considered.
Mm-hmm. Interesting points. John, do you want to take a start?
Sure. Well, actually, I really appreciate, Ivy, your concerns, and they're right on track with a lot of the research that we're doing. And in fact, switchgrass is a native. It is a prairie species. So that right there kind of gets us going in the right direction. We actually have a lot of experimental plots which are actually looking at not just planting one species of perennial, but actually planting, you know, several different species and really getting to something which looks more like a prairie restoration, providing diversity both in terms of those plant species, but then correspondingly for the animals, you know, that we really need to be concerned about in terms of our ecosystem. So it's the birds, it's also the insects as well. And so we're really looking at that full spectrum of biodiversity, concerns, and corresponding to the opportunities we might have to put a more diverse, more diversity into our agricultural landscape. I think, you know, done right, we should be able to do that with these biofuel crops. You mentioned harvesting timing, and that's a really interesting story in that actually most of the harvesting would take place in late fall, even early winter, at a point in time when we wouldn't be disturbing nesting birds and related. So it also is a time when most of the nutrients have been, as I mentioned earlier, a little bit have been pulled back down into the ground. So we're really leaving those nutrients for next year's growth and just taking essentially the carbon which we need for the fuel.
Just unrelated, and thanks, Ivy, again for calling. Related, we had a Facebook comment from Brody, and this relates to switchgrass. He got some seed, of some free seed from the DNR. It turned out that there was a non-native ecotype switchgrass in there, which turned into a problem in his prairie. So he, you know, it's sort of taking over the prairie. So watching out for what you plant could be, you know, you could have a disaster environmentally that way too. I mean, we've got some plants out there that I wish we didn't have.
Definitely. In the world of environmental study and whatnot, we talk about invasive species. And this is really something that's critical, both in terms of within a field and then clearly if something, you know, gets more broadly distributed into the landscape. And so and this is where some of our studies were actually planting multiple species and seeing how they interact is really important. So we're really testing that out. But that's very interesting. It's the first time I've heard, of that type of a situation. And I think, how do you balance the needs of different plants when you're planting what we call a polyculture is really important. What's interesting is we know how to do that within the context of hay. Most of our hay fields are a mixture of alfalfa and grasses of different varieties and whatnot. And so we have the conceptual framework to develop those kinds of polyculture crops.
Is there somebody mentioned, more than one person has said, what about all these invasives that we do have? Knotweed, we've got Phragmites. God, wouldn't it be great if we could just harvest it? But there's a lot of problems associated with that.
Yeah, having the equipment to harvest it would be one thing. I mean, that would be a start. And again, the logistics. Is it even worth your while to get in and harvest a bitty bit of an acre?
That's the problem.
Yeah.
John.
We really just don't want to get in a situation where people begin to plant some of these species. You know, Phragmites is a good example. Reed canary is another one that would probably make a great biofuel crop, but the environmental implications are just, we don't even want to go close. But
And on the other end of that, how are you going to sell your bitty bit of Phragmites or reed canary grass when people who run power plants or otherwise make contracts are looking for a steady supply of whatever biomass you're producing?
Can we convert oil-based heating systems into using biomass, or can we? Can that be done? Are engineers working on that?
Well, there's some really interesting examples of that where on relatively small, it seems like frequently commercial scale, it's easy to convert from heating with oil or gas or whatever and moving into biomass. So actually pelletizing, for example, switchgrass material or similar, and then there are furnaces out there that'll take that type of material.
Well, Carol and John, thank you so much. We ran out of time. It goes really fast. Thank you so much. We'll do this again. Carol Barford directs the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment. John Greenler directs education for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. And I didn't get through all my questions. Maybe you had some questions, too. We'll bring them back and we'll do it again. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.